Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
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 Great to be here.
Who's on the show this week?
Hey there. Adam Higginbotham.
Oh, yeah.
Adam Higginbotham.
Oh, that guy.
Bylines everywhere from Details to GQ, Wired, New Yorker. But this week, he's got a new story in The Atavist.
What's the story called?
1,000 pounds of dynamite. And I would say to those who might think that he's only on the show because of that story, first of all, he's written a lot of amazing stories. That's why we assigned him that piece in the first place. And second of all, I would defy anyone to read that story and then say that we shouldn't talk about it on this show.
It's a yarn.
I heard it's dynamite.
Nice one.
Magic.
Nice one.
What about sponsors?
Well, we got a tiny letter from the good people at MailChimp. It's a simple but so profoundly powerful way to get a email newsletter off the ground. There's lots of great tiny letters out there. You're probably getting one in your inbox. Why not start one yourself?
All right. Here's Max with Adam Higginbotham.
Hello, Adam Higginbotham.
Good afternoon.
How are you, sir?
Very well.
Thank you for coming to the office on a Sunday afternoon. I feel bad. I feel like we've interrupted your weekend.
You have, but I'm happy to have it interrupted.
Man, I have so many things that I want to talk to you about, but I think we should start with this story that you just wrote for The Atavist.
Okay.
Okay, so here's the thing. When Longform hit 2 years, we went back and we picked like our favorite articles ever, and I couldn't figure out how to pick which stories because there had been so many that I loved. And so I decided to just search my email for the phrase holy shit and just find stories that I had sent to people. And all I could say was holy shit, like the holy shit stories. This story you've written is a holy shit story, man. This story's insane. It's completely bonkers.
It is. And that's what I thought when I first heard it. And then the more I found out about it, the more I thought, well, this is kind of ridiculous.
It's called 1,000 pounds of dynamite, and maybe before we get into it, you could just sort of recap it for people.
It's a historical story. It's about something that happened in 1980 when a Hungarian emigre who had bankrupted himself at the tables of casinos in Lake Tahoe decided that he was going to get his money back by building an extremely complex bomb in his garage with the help of his two teenage sons and deliver it into one of these casinos in the middle of the night, accompanied by an extortion note asking for $3 million in return for instructions on how to defuse it.
One important note, I'm just going to, we're going to keep going, but one important note is you could not actually defuse the bomb.
The bomb was undefusable. So the instructions that he planned to provide them with were actually instructions on how to safely take it somewhere else so that it could blow up without hurting anybody, probably.
Okay. I mean, I don't know how much of the story we're going to spoil. I don't want to spoil all of it.
It doesn't end well.
It doesn't end well. We can say that he successfully gets the bomb into the casino. Can we say that?
He does. Like all the best crime stories, he nearly gets away with it.
Which is kind of amazing because like everything else about the plan is not strong. The finishing act is not well conceived.
No.
But the bomb is this incredible work of art.
The bomb is kind of brilliant, yeah. And all the FBI guys and the bomb guys who examined it at the time still say that.
There's a long section in the story about the bomb, but maybe you could just give us like the brief version, because it's amazing. It's a holy shit bomb.
How would I describe this thing? Well, it was a box. It was a box that he filled with nearly 1,000 pounds of dynamite, as much as they could get into it.
That's not as catchy a title for a story. Nearly 1,000 pounds of dynamite.
They stole 1,000 pounds of dynamite, but the box wasn't quite big enough to fit it all in. And then, rather than just being, you know, a bomb with a timer, it was a bomb with a timer that he turned on and then sealed inside. And then he booby-trapped it in such a way that if you tried to take the top off it or get into it to turn the timer off, then it would go off. Well, the other thing that the FBI agents found remarkable about this device was that although he was kind of technically gifted, he built it using things anyone could find lying around in their local hardware store. So, for instance, he devised a mechanism whereby you couldn't stop it working by filling with water or foam, because he got a float from a toilet cistern and put it in there, so that if the ball on the cistern rose, if you flooded the bomb, then the bomb would go off. He lined it with layers of tin foil and neoprene, so that if you drilled into the box from the outside, it would make an electrical contact with the foil, and then it would set the bomb off. He had a sort of a trembler switch that he'd made out of a piece of plumbing pipe and a rubber band and a pendulum, and then lined the pipe with foil, so that if you move the box at all, then the pendulum would make contact with the foil and it would set the bomb off. I mean, he had, and there were 8 different fusing mechanisms.
The bomb is kind of brilliant.
It is.
And the other thing about the guy's name is John Burgess?
John Burgess.
And
Janos Burgess was his original name.
And what's amazing about Big John is what he's referred to throughout the story. Big John, what's amazing about him is that he had come here penniless and made millions. Like, he'd made a fortune.
Right.
Enough to gamble it all away.
He became very, very successful. He became very successful as a landscaper in California and made a lot of money by getting a lot of municipal contracts, including that for landscaping the grounds of the federal court building in which he was ultimately tried.
That must have been a strange moment. I wonder if he, like, when he was walking in, he was like looking at the hedges, or maybe he'd only be able to look at it out the window.
And thinking, yeah, I should have done those differently.
I should have kept this going. But the thing that's crazy, right, you think about like people who would be driven to like elaborate bomb extortion plots are not people who have readily made fortunes earlier in their lives.
He's not an obvious loser, is what you're really saying.
Yeah, okay, that's a good way of putting it. Sure.
Right?
Yeah. Or like an obvious crazy person.
Right. And his problem really was that he didn't see himself that way either, and he didn't think other people should see him that way, which is why he became so outraged when he lost all his money, because he thought he was cleverer than everyone else.
Right. He liked to think that he could beat the odds.
Yeah.
And then this was like the ultimate trying to beat the odds.
Exactly.
The other thing that's interesting about the story and the bomb in particular is that it has this long section about how it works, like you just described, and tinkering and tinkerers are like a real theme in your work. You seem to like come back again and again to criminals who do sort of elaborate mechanical tasks, and also who kind of want you to know how brilliant they are, which is a Big John trait.
I think that is true, yeah, but hadn't realized that until you mentioned it.
We'll get back to that. Here's the thing that I kept thinking about while I was reading the story. So they do get the bomb in to the casino.
Right.
Right. And there is a prolonged period when the bomb is in the casino and this impossible to defuse bomb is being looked at by massive amounts of law enforcement and like media, right? Throughout the story, there's these videos of the scene outside the casino.
Right.
The thing I was thinking about while I was reading is like, if this happened now, it would break the internet.
It's part of the reason that I found the story was fascinating is because you can think so many things about it that begin, if this happened now.
Right. And it's like, as you're reading it, someone brought a gigantic bomb filled with nearly 1,000 pounds of dynamite into a major casino in Lake Tahoe. And I never heard about it before.
A few days before Labor Day weekend.
It's so wild. And it's like, it's kind of lost to history, or at least right. It was before you wrote right. this piece. I couldn't believe it as I was reading it that this wasn't something that, like, you know, I heard about when I was 10.
Like, well, that's exactly what I thought when I first read about it. I was like, wait, this happened and I've never heard of it.
I know. This thing happened, whatever, 35 years ago, and I feel like I can't say the end of it because I don't want to spoil the story, but it's like, how does everyone not know the end of this story?
Can probably say no one was killed.
No one, yeah, that's true. No one was killed.
Because obviously I asked people involved in it, why. For many of them, the kind of peak of their careers in law enforcement is lost to history. And they said, you know, it's because everybody walked away. I mean, everybody walked away intact. I mean,
right.
People involved didn't all get to walk away anywhere.
And some other people didn't walk away whole.
Right.
Oh, man, can we just say what happened? I don't want to blow it. I mean, you can. This is a story that's put out by the Atavist, and you should go buy this thing. I really recommend that you buy the article. It is fantastic. But I just want to talk about what happens because I just read it last night and I want to talk to you about it. So they get the bomb in to the casino, this massive bomb. They leave a note asking for $3 million. the bomb is impossible to defuse, and eventually, on live television, this bomb goes off in the casino. There's no one in it. No one in the casino. No one is hurt, right, like you said. But they, like, blew a gigantic hole.
They blew a six-story hole through the middle of one of the largest casinos in the United States.
Holy shit. Holy shit. Here's what I'm saying. If that is happening now, right? If, like, right now, you know, we're both sitting here with, like, our phones on this table. If all of a sudden I got a text message that was like, there's a casino or there's a giant bomb in a casino somewhere, we would, like, stop what we were doing and we would start following this thing. Like, it would be everywhere. It would have been the entire, I feel like the entire, like, focus of the internet would have been on that casino.
Right. And somebody on Reddit would have come up with a way of defusing it.
Absolutely. They would have figured it out, right? They would have figured it out. Totally. And I just couldn't stop thinking about that while I was reading the story. It was like, here's this thing that is kind of just lost to history, and it's totally one of these stories. It's like, it felt like the, you know, the Malaysian airliner. You know, it was one of these. If it was happening now, it would have been the lead story everywhere. It would have had the entire world's focus, and it's just,
well, it was the lead story everywhere in the United States while it was happening, and then, you know, a year later, everybody had forgotten. Well, 2 years later, everybody had forgotten about it.
Yeah, I guess that's maybe how it would work too. Now, maybe we would just forget about these things, but it's pretty amazing. So Burgess isn't allowed to tell you about the story, but who did you, like, how did you find it and how did you start getting back into it?
I found it because I was actually researching another story that I was interested in, another historical story. And I was reading an oral history project interview with an FBI agent who had been working in Las Vegas at the time, talking about this other case I was interested in. And he mentioned in passing that a couple of years earlier, he'd been roped in to work on this case where this Hungarian emigre had blown up this casino in Lake Tahoe. And I had that, wait, what? Really? Are you sure about this reaction? And then the more I read about it, the more I thought, well hang on, why has nobody told this story?
Why do you think that is? Why do you think no one has done that story?
I think because it was covered a lot at the time, partly because it's, you know, like a local newspaper reporter wrote a 3-part series about it on the 25th anniversary of it. It's been locally, it's still a big deal. I mean, if you go to Lake Tahoe and ask anybody about Harvey's Casino, then they'll, you know, the first thing they'll tell you about it is that this crazy guy blew the place up in 1980. And when I was researching the story, I was constantly meeting people. Like when I went to the courthouse to look over the documents they have in the state courthouse, you know, one of the court clerks said to me, oh, yeah, my uncle works security at Harvey's. You know, and so it's a thing in that area. But more broadly, you know, it has been forgotten about.
Another critical part of the story is that his co-conspirators kind of are his kids. Or his two sons.
Right, his two sons.
And one, you were able to talk to...
I mean, with the exception of Big John and his wife, who died, you know, sometime before the conspiracy took place, I mean, pretty much everyone else involved in the crime and the investigation is still around, and I spoke to a lot of them. So I spoke to both the sons. I spoke to almost all of the surviving FBI agents, and the U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case in federal court. You know, there's a lot of people still around.
And I guess, were they, I mean, 25 years, 35 years later, were they ready to tell that story? Like, were they game?
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, the lead investigator for the Nevada side of the investigation, you know, still lectures. I mean, he went on to become a pretty well-established bomb technician and then worked on the Oklahoma City bombing and the first World Trade Center bombing. And one of the other bomb techs worked on the Lockerbie bombing. So, I mean, he was lecturing about this case last month at an international Association of Bomb Technicians symposium. So yeah, he was more than happy to talk about it. But you know, there were other people involved in the investigation who nobody has spoken to about this since it happened, pretty much, and not at the time. And those guys were fascinating to talk to.
I'm sure. I mean, it just blows my mind that no one had gone and, like, really done this story. What were his kids like?
His kids have, I mean, the story is not really going to upset anyone's expectations of people turning out the way you think they will 40 years later if you set them on a certain trajectory. So the one son, John, is a very nice guy, but his life was completely derailed by what happened. And he never really recovered from it. The younger son, Jim, just kind of carried on almost unimpeded. Now is it never even left Fresno, where they both lived, and is now a successful businessman and is just finished with his second marriage, has three kids, coaches Little League, has a business.
It's amazing. They were almost estranged before it started, and it's this thing kind of brought them back.
I never got them in a room together. They don't talk to one another. There's a point in the story where the right at the beginning, where the conspiracy begins, where Jim goes around to John's house, and John's first words to him, being someone he hasn't spoken to in a couple of years, his first words to him are pretty much, "What the fuck are you doing here?" Right. And the last time I spoke to Jim Burgess, he said that he and his then wife had recently gone down to Ventura from Fresno to visit John. And he said that when John caught sight of them, the first thing he did was turn around and said, "What the fuck are you doing here?" So it really hasn't changed.
I feel like a thing that has changed, or maybe the reason that the story kind of also didn't have this kind of lasting appeal or something, was that they get caught. They almost don't get caught.
Right.
Right. But then obviously they do. We know who they are. And the other thing, it felt like that was also specific to that time that they weren't caught, because it wasn't like an elaborate mastermind.
But no, plot. Absolutely not.
Like it was almost an accident that they didn't get caught.
Right, because they stole the £1,000 of dynamite. He didn't go into a store and buy it. He ripped it off.
And they get away with that. They're like, everything is closed. They're taking their own cars. Like, I just feel like with the like a level of like surveillance,
exactly.
None of it could happen. Right. It just feels like this really brief moment where you could pull something like that off, where like the level of surveillance isn't there, but the level of technology is, and there's places like Tahoe with huge buildings that I don't know. It just feels like it's this. It could only happen in this one really brief moment.
No, it's amazing. I mean, because they stole £1,000 of dynamite, and the FBI began one of the largest investigations in the history of the agency, which continued for a year before they were alerted to the fact that someone had stolen £1,000 of dynamite.
It's amazing. Well, anyway, I don't want to ruin any more of this story. We should, you should just go buy it.
Buy it, definitely. Please
buy it.
Buy it.
That's a new thing for you, right? Trying to sell a story. Have you done that before? Done the a la carte story thing
directly to the consumer? Yes, that is the first time I've.
How's it going so far?
Oh, it came out yesterday. So, you know, I'm just sitting here drumming my fingers and
just waiting for the trucks to back up to your house with piles of cash.
The giant check to be presented to me.
All right, well, let's go back in time a little bit. Our more astute listeners will have picked up on the fact that you're British.
I am.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about where you got your start, how you got your start doing this stuff.
A long time ago. I'm one of those people that never wanted to do anything else except be a journalist. And so as soon as I left college, I got a job on a music magazine in London. And I kind of followed that trajectory until it burned out, because this was the 90s, which in Britain certainly was the kind of last golden age of magazine publishing. And I worked at one of the two biggest magazine publishing companies in Britain, which was a fantastic place to work, because the place was run by people who'd come up through editorial, and they had an extremely liberal and inspired attitude to the way they went about their business, which was that they essentially handed the keys to the car to people like me at the age of, you know, like 24 or 25, and let us do pretty much anything we wanted.
And what'd you do?
Well, so by the time I was 30, I was editing my second or third magazine. And so you could, you know, but you could just put things in print. You could just go and you have an idea, and the next week you'd be doing it.
That is an incredible thing. I edited a newspaper when I was way too young to be editing a newspaper.
Right.
And that moment where, like, you just, like, put up something that you think is funny on the cover of the paper, and then it's just out there in the world. It's a pretty, mm-hmm. pretty crazy moment.
It is, and then there are those other moments where you've done that, and you discover that you've done something tremendously costly to your employers.
Horribly wrong.
Yeah. which we did do. And I think on my watch, we once had an entire print run of the magazine that I worked on at the time withdrawn and pulped.
Oh, that's a great time. That's a fun way to spend an evening. What happened? What was the thing?
We created a parody magazine within a magazine, and we were attempting to make an ad in the pages of that magazine look more realistic. So we took the logo of a government body.
For listeners at home, Adam is hanging his head in shame as he tells the story.
Off an advert for that government body and simply pasted it into the page of the magazine.
Strong choice.
Yeah. And then we printed it. Then we got a letter from a lawyer. So that was an important lesson, but there was a lot of that. So I spent 9 or 10 years, but learning by doing,
and doing a lot from the office. I mean, you were running magazines and managing people and editing stories.
Right.
Did you like that side of the world?
I did like doing it, and I kind of miss working in an office because I miss that environment. But you know, this was at a time when people didn't still yet really use email. So I kind of, you know, I spent much of my working day talking to people on the telephone, and
right.
you know, that world has gone. So I don't really know what working in a magazine office is. Whenever I go to magazine offices now, I'm kind of struck by how terribly silent
it's
and
really
lonely
quiet.
They
it's
seem.
Really quiet. I mean, we're taping this on a Sunday in our office. It is exactly as loud as it will be 24 hours from now.
Right.
This is pretty much it. Yeah. Everyone's got headphones, and everyone's chatting each other.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy.
So yes, I did do a lot of editing.
But while you were working at that point, I mean, was the goal to start writing these longer stories to be freelance? I mean, you know, just looking through like the chronology of your history before we talked, like it seems like you were sort of on this one path, and then something changed.
It wasn't really like that. I always really liked writing, but I'm one of those people whose career for a long time was determined by the jobs I was offered. So, you know, certainly at that time, if you proved your ability at writing, pretty soon you would be offered a job as an editor. So then I took that job as an editor, and then I did that for a little while, and then I became quite frustrated and tired of it, and because, you know, I wasn't getting out and doing the stuff that I'd started doing, going out and reporting and writing things. So I quit.
I'm going to stop you there, because I feel like lots of people never quit. I think that experience of, like, you're a pretty good writer and some more money gets thrown at you to, like, sit at a desk and maybe, I don't know, like, you have a family or kids or something, and you take that job, and then you get kind of used to having a little bit more money and a little bit more security, and you stick with it and you don't quit. I think that happens to a lot of people.
Right. But I think at this point I was still so young. I didn't have any responsibilities or any commitments. So I was just like, you know what? Fuck it. I don't want your job. What actually happened was I was offered the job of editor-in-chief of that magazine. And in the meeting, I was like, by that time, I'd already seen too many movies, and I almost literally said to the guy who was you know, one of my mentors at the time and taught me an awful lot, I almost literally said, "Fuck you and your job. I'm not interested. In fact, I'm quitting the job I have." So then I did go freelance, and I started.
Then you walked out and said, "What the fuck have I just done?"
Well, but it was funny. It was like, they paid me so little money. It wasn't like I was in financial. I was putting myself in terrible financial straits because I just
you were
went
like turning down the company jet or anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I'd started kind of properly. By that time, I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do, and I wanted to write like long, deeply reported features. And I actually started working for American magazines. I got an assignment from Details in the different incarnation it was in then, and started writing for places here. And I was like, I can't believe this is happening. This is fantastic. But then I got offered another job, this time to launch my own magazine. And so it's like, you know, it's the Michael Corleone thing. It's like, keep trying to get out, and they keep pulling. And so I said, oh, okay, yeah, that'll be great. I'll do that. So then I cut off this, you know, sort of budding career that I had in it. And in fact, was in the middle of reporting a story for, I can't believe I did this either. I was in the middle of reporting a story for Details at the time. And I eventually rang up the assigning editor, and I said, terribly sorry, I can't finish this story because I've been asked to launch a magazine. I hope you understand. Which, you know, deeply regrettable.
Fuck you and fuck your job.
Stupid thing to do. but then I went back into editing magazines for another couple of years.
And that was The Face?
No, that was another magazine. Oh. Then I got The Face job, and then after that was, I don't know. Then in 1999, I left that job, and that time, then I was like, now I've finally got that out. I've really got that out of my system. I know next time to say no.
can I ask a naive question?
Yeah.
Was there a culture of doing sort of deeply reported long stories in the UK? Like, was the choice do this brand of British journalism or do these long reported features for American magazines?
There is a bit of that, because there wasn't that culture of that. But you could, if you wanted to do it, I mean, the attitude that I encountered then was really like, you know, like someone who insists on playing their own mandolin that they've built by hand in their workshop from their own original 15th century blueprints. It's like, well, sure, you can do that if you want, but, you know, you could just play this guitar that you could buy in a store. So then I did start doing these things, you know, and I spent... You know, one of the first things I did, I spent a year reporting. And the guys that I did it for, they were extremely happy with it when I finished it, but they also thought I was a little bit mental for doing that.
It wasn't like it fit into some hole that they needed to fill in the magazine. It was like a special, different thing we're going to do this month.
Well, no, because by that time I worked, the one place where you could do that kind of stuff, and there was a culture of it, was in the Sunday supplements for Sunday newspapers, like the equivalent of the New York Times magazine in England. So I would do things like that for them. I mean, I would do sort of shorter profile pieces and other stuff, but I would also work on these other things, which are what I kind of really wanted to do.
I read this story. It's like the first one on your website. I went back and read some of your stuff. But the earliest one that you have listed is a profile of Richard Branson.
Oh, yeah. So that was one of the Sunday stories I did. I haven't read that in a long time.
Do you remember any of it?
Oh, I remember doing it. Yeah, I remember doing it vividly.
It's like, I think it's like 2000.
Yes.
So he's Richard Branson, but he's not like Richard Branson.
Right.
At that point.
Yeah. He was in Britain, but he wasn't kind of the global figure he has become.
Right. And basically the story, I'll try and explain it back to you since you might not remember it, is you get wasted with Richard Branson. Basically the story.
Definitely. He likes to drink. I went to his birthday party. He had a cricket match in the garden of his home in Oxfordshire, and he would invite, you know, 100 or 120 people, and he would start drinking in the morning, and he liked to drink. And I ended up, because actually this story was provided an important lesson for me, which is never to drink while working. Because during the course of the day, I didn't drink anything. And then at the end of the day, very late at night, and I'd spend most of the day with him, then we sat down and began drinking over a tape recorder. And I got a fantastic interview out of him for hour and a half, because what happened is that we started drinking, and I had a couple of glasses of champagne with him. And then after about 15 minutes, I went to the bathroom and I did something I would never do now, which is I put the tape recorder on pause. And he got drunker and drunker. I was kind of moderating my consumption of alcohol, but he got drunker and drunker and more entertaining and told me more and more fantastic stories with more reckless details in them for some time before I realized that I had never released the pause button on the tape recorder. And then Richard Branson was such a nice guy that he and I, he said, oh my God, no, this is terrible. What can we do about this? Can you remember what we're talking about? And then he and I turned the tape recorder on and drunkenly attempted to reconstruct the conversation we had at the preceding hour. I don't think I need to tell you that doesn't work very well.
It seemed like it worked okay for the story.
Well, yeah, but there was loads of stuff I wasn't able to use in the story because I didn't have it on tape and neither of us could remember it.
The other kind of running theme of that story is that he keeps like stealing cigarettes from you. Like he had just quit smoking and he was on the board of whatever the like parents against smoking is in Britain. Yes. He's the head of that organization.
Yeah.
And throughout the story, like you guys keep sneaking away and stealing a butt. And he's like terrified that like his kid is going to come around the corner at the wrong time
exactly.
and catch him.
Yes, because his kids were kind of either young teenagers or kind of preteens at that point.
And then it ends with this kind of wonderful moment, which was I think the very end of your hour and a half long drunken conversation, in which he talks about like this like terrible dream he keeps having where he loses a house.
Oh yeah. A very realistic prospect, it
seems
to me.
Yeah, the kicker of the thing was just kind of like, the whole piece is about like what it's like to be kind of rich, massive celebrity Richard Branson, and it ends with him just being like, "Here, the worst thing about me, like the thing I don't want anyone to know is that I literally have dreams where I lose my houses. I misplace houses. There's a period of your life where you're working in these British magazines, and after that, you're kind of just freelancing, right? I mean, I assume you're on contract a couple of places and stuff, but you've written for maybe more publications than anyone who we've had on the show. It's just a serious list.
Really? Okay. Well, the list now goes on longer than I'd like to admit. I don't think
that's a bad thing. Why is that a bad thing?
But I look at it, I'm like, somebody asked me the other day, how long have you been doing this? I was like, 25 years. Oh, no.
A while.
Yeah.
The answer is a while.
A while.
Yeah, a bit. Yeah. still finding my way. So one part of your writing is the stuff I was just asking you about in these sort of profiles and but you've also just got these yarns. The Atavist is the latest one, but there's so many sort of great, really intricate crime stories in particular that I'd like to talk to you about. I don't even know where to start exactly. Inkjet counterfeiter. Can we talk about the inkjet counterfeiter?
Sure, I'd love to. Albert.
Yeah, Albert. Hold Albert. Also, for the record, like a tinkering guy in California who really wanted people to know what a great tinker he was.
Yep. And a pretty nice guy. Unlike Big John, who was a total monster.
Yeah.
Albert, kind of nice guy.
Can you give the like quick version of that story?
He was a kind of career petty criminal who went from check fraud to counterfeiting U.S. currency. And he managed to eventually pass, as they say in the Secret Service, more than $7 million worth of counterfeit currency that he had printed on inkjet printers in his bedroom using supplies from Staples.
When he started, did not know how to use a computer.
He did not have a computer. I don't know whether he didn't know. He certainly didn't know his way around any graphic design programs or anything like that. No.
How do you find that story? I mean, how do you find all these stories? Where are you looking? How did that one come about?
That one was in the newspaper. That was in what I now regard as a kind of a better resourced, thicker New York Times, where the list of crazy stories in the home news, national news section would be quite long. So it was in that kind of narrow column of stories down the right hand side of the page where it's like, you know, 75 words from Associated Press. And so it was one of those stories about this guy, Albert Tolton, who'd been arrested for counterfeiting $7 million in U.S. currency that he printed at home. And I wrote him a letter, and he wrote back to me. And so that's how I got that. Well, and also I got the cooperation of the Secret Service, which I didn't realize at the time was quite as rare as it is.
Yeah, I wondered why they... were so open with you, because it felt like it would kind of inspire someone to counterfeit bills.
They're pretty careful about what they tell you and what they won't tell you. They're, as it turns out, they're one of the more conservative agencies in terms of allowing access to their staff.
The whole story, Albert's whole story, kind of makes you think, like, maybe I could do this.
Well, that's exactly why he started, because his boss at the body shop he worked at showed him a counterfeit 50 and said, and he and Albert thought to himself, you know, I could do a lot better than that.
So what happens? Okay, so you send him a letter, you send him your stuff, and he's like, yeah.
I've written a lot of letters to people in prison, I should say, at this point.
Well, how often are they game to talk?
Like 1 in 10.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just don't receive a reply most of the time.
Well, I assume that's a no.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
But Albert was game.
He was eventually. I wrote to him and requested an interview, and the prison set up the interview, and then by that time I was calling him from a hotel room in Los Angeles because I had flown there so that I could try, and if he agreed to talk to me face to face and the prison would let me do it, they could just go and do it. So I'd set up this, what I was allowed was a 30-minute telephone interview with him. And then he got on the line, and the first thing he said was, why should I talk to you? And then I had to spend 25 minutes of my 30 minutes talking him into talking to me. I assumed he had consented, but he hadn't. He wanted to get the measure of me on the phone.
How do you go about doing that?
I cannot remember. I think I told him what my intention was with the story, and that, you know, I wanted to... By that time, I'd had the Secret Service version of the story, which is, you know, obviously a very sanitized governmental narrative. But I wanted to find out how he had ended up doing this, and where, because by that time he was in his early 40s. I mean, and he had come to this level of criminality pretty late in life. So I was curious about how he had done it. But I was also aware of the fact that someone who had done something like this was going to want people to know how clever and ingenious it was. And that turned out to be the case. I mean, when he started to tell me his story, you know, he explained that this ingenuity had gone back into his teens and that he had been in the middle of studying, I think, like electrical engineering or something at college in Long Beach. And what had happened, this isn't in the story, I don't think, but what had happened is that he'd got his girlfriend pregnant, and so he had to leave college. So he was his dreams of white collar success were derailed at this point, and it eventually drove him into illegal ways of making a living.
Do you ever like follow up? You get the letter from someone in prison. You go and meet them, and they don't have that kind of like motivating backstory. Like you can't. Is the story ever not there once you get that far down the line, or are you in a place where you can just kind of make it happen? Like, is there always a story behind $7 million in counterfeiter bills?
There's always a story with the crime. I mean, part of the reason it's appealing to both report and to read crime stories is that there's always a narrative, you know, because something has always gone wrong. Because if it hadn't, you wouldn't be reading about it. You know, these guys are always in prison. Unless it's a mystery story, then these guys are always in prison. And they ended up in prison because they fucked something up, or they trusted the wrong person, or they, you know. And in Albert Tolton's case, even if he hadn't had this interesting background or background that kind of lends itself to explaining in part how he ends up this way, being this kind of, you know, thwarted, ingenious guy, there's a lot of fascinating stuff about how he got caught. Because he's like Big John in the Atavist story. He just, if he hadn't gone in with these knuckleheads,
right,
then he'd be still driving his Aston Martin DB7 around Glendale right now.
So the story is really about how people screwed it up, not how they pulled it off.
Well, because ultimately, I mean, and this is what, you know, detectives will tell you, is that they always get caught in the end. I mean, very rarely do criminals kind of just get away scot-free for decades and you know, retire to Hawaii.
Right, and even if they do, they eventually get caught.
Right.
Usually. It seems like you have an eye for those stories that are those kind of like just holy shit stories. The idea that this guy could have just kind of up out of nowhere figured out how to counterfeit $7 million right. worth of bills is kind of mind-blowing. It just seems like it feels like it's out of a movie. Like it feels like it shouldn't be real. And it seems like those are the kinds of stories that you gravitate towards.
Yeah, that's true. Because I think, before I came in here, I was trying to look over the things that I'd written, you know, over the last 10 years, trying to find some, you know, unifying theory of what I'm interested in. And the fact is that I think that what I'm really interested in is narrative, you know, and drama. So those are the things that I'm attracted to. And to a certain extent, I'm just looking for things where I think I would love to find out how that happened, you know.
That's the guiding principle.
Right, exactly.
You're just following your own curiosity.
Right.
Talk about the other story I wanted to ask you about was the Gangster Prince of Liberia, the Charlie Taylor story.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, maybe different a bit from your other stories in terms of the scale of the impact that the person had. Right. So part of what makes the counterfeiter or Big John of these stories really cinematic and kind of fun, they're kind of fun to talk about and they're like fun to read, is that no one really gets hurt.
Right, exactly. I mean, because I've written stories about, I mean, a long time ago I wrote a story about a serial killer, which I was actually in the middle of reporting and I suddenly realized how upsetting I was finding.
That was the GQ piece?
Oh, no, not that. No, that guy, the longest serving convict in the United States.
65 years, right?
Before, a long time before that, I wrote a story about the Green River Killer in Seattle, who was this guy who, I mean, this statistic is constantly being trotted out about various different people, but at the time he was regarded as the kind of most prolific serial killer in American history. And when I was reporting that, the details of the story are so disturbing that I found it very difficult to work on.
Mm-hmm. And so, have you sort of since then kind of veered away from that kind of story?
I think subconsciously I probably have, because I'm not curious about what goes on in the minds of those people, because, you know, those people are crazy.
To get back just to that Gangster Prince of Liberia story, that's not a lighthearted story.
It is not a lighthearted story, no.
Could you just describe it quickly?
It is about the probably oldest son of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, who was raised as a kind of lower middle class kid in suburban Florida. And then when he was, I can't remember now, maybe 16 or 17, went to visit his father in Liberia at the point when his father was planning to overthrow the Liberian government. And then when Taylor did in fact overthrow the Liberian government and installed himself as its de facto dictator, his son Chucky went back to Monrovia and became the Uday Hussein of sub-Saharan Africa.
It's a hell of a moniker.
And that was certainly not a lighthearted story, because he ran basically a torture center in the jungle in Liberia, was responsible for, I have no idea how many atrocities, but he was made the test case in a prosecution under a law that was put on the books under the Bush administration that makes U.S. citizens prosecutable for crimes of torture committed abroad. So,
and he was the first one, right?
And he was the first one. He was eventually, after I wrote the story, he was tried and found guilty and will be in prison for the rest of his life, I think.
He didn't write you back?
It's funny you should say that, because I never wrote to him.
How come?
Because I didn't think he would write back to me, but I have no idea, because I spent more than a year reporting that story.
Yeah.
And I contacted everybody that I could. It's sort of a write around. And the guy was sitting there in Miami the whole time I was working on it. And then somebody actually did subsequently do another story about him, in which they corresponded with him in prison. But it wasn't, I don't think, any more enlightening about his personality than if he hadn't written to them.
One more story I want to ask you about, and then I will let you go. I'll let you out of this boiling hot room. You wrote a piece in The New Yorker, I think...
Last year. Yeah.
About window washers.
Right. That was entertaining to do.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And it was also, like, I feel like I keep asking you, like, how'd you come up with that story? How'd you find that story? That one seems pretty clear. It's like you just looked up someday, right?
No, I was reading the paper. I read the paper and there was a story. I mean, I'm sure you remember this. There was, because this is a kind of big tabloid story. These two window washers fell off the top of a 60-story building on the Upper East Side.
The brothers.
Yeah, the brothers.
Yeah. Right?
And one of them was killed. So that was a big story. But then what was a smaller story was about 6 months later, another window washer was killed falling, you know, 8 stories from somewhere in the West Village. And at that point, the second story was in the New York Times, and they interviewed the guy's widow, and his widow said this, because this quote is in the finished piece, I think, where she says something to the effect of, people don't realize that being married to a window washer is like being married to a policeman or a firefighter. And I was like, really? Is it really that dangerous? Christ. So at that point, I thought, well, there's something in this.
Yeah. I mean, that was another one of these stories where I was just surprised it hadn't been done.
Well, to be honest, it was more specifically than that. I couldn't believe The New Yorker had never done it, because it seemed like if you were kind of creating a template for a New Yorker story,
yeah,
that would be it. So I, you know, before I pitched it, I went into the archive and I discovered they'd written about a window washer precisely once in 1935.
How many times were you able to go up?
Up where?
Up on the top of buildings.
I mean, I could have gone up as often as I wanted to, I think, by the
end.
Did
you not want to go up very often?
Well, it's fine. It's the being on the top of a building, it does not bother me at all. Being on the top of a window washing rig, being swung out over the parapet of a building in a high wind, is not something I'd want to do very frequently. And being on the top of the Empire State Building, where there's no guardrail, and the parapet came up to just above my knees on a catwalk that was probably 2 feet or 18 inches wide, is not something I'd ever do again.
You found this whole kind of this whole world of these guys who watch rooms, right. Almost all guys.
One guy told me that there used to be a woman, but she quit.
They must have treated her so well.
Yes, it's not a macho world or anything.
But they let you into it. I mean, they must have been so excited to have someone care.
Not at all.
Really? No. How many assumptions can I have about the story that are wrong?
It was very hard to get people to talk to me for that story. Because, I mean, as I explain in the job, in the story, the job is kind of, it's a unionized, the guys that I spoke to, it was a unionized gig. And once infamous for the brevity of its hours, I think was the term I eventually used. And part of the reason the job appeals to the guys that do it is because there is literally nobody looking over their shoulder and they can do what they want.
Right. It's about a 4-hour workday.
Right. Used to be, that's what they said, used to be a 4-hour workday. Everything's changed now.
Sure.
And so they had no interest in having somebody hang around and watch what they were doing or not doing, or, you know, whether they were adhering to the extremely stringent safety regulations of the job, whether they were showing up. And also, you know, the building owners themselves certainly did not want me doing it. I mean, I spent months and months trying through the union to get access to these, to go out onto these rigs, and having a lot of incidents where I was stood up at 4 o'clock in the morning standing outside high-rise buildings in Manhattan with a cup of coffee in my hand, and people just wouldn't show up. And I just kept being told I couldn't do that.
It's kind of ironic that it ended up being the Hearst Tower.
The reason that it happened was because in the end, I stopped the routes I'd been attempting to pursue, which was by going through the window cleaners themselves and going through the union. And in the end, I wrote to the owners of the Hearst Building. And said, you know, I'm interested in going out on the rig on this building, because I'd already interviewed the window washers there. So I knew all about, and everybody knew that the rig on the Hearst Building was the most complex at that time in Manhattan. So this was the one I really wanted to write about.
Right.
And the guys who washed the windows were like, absolutely not. We don't want you anywhere. You know, you're not allowed to come in here. I'll talk to you in the cafe down the street, but, you know, can't come in here. And the Hearst people just wrote back and they said, sure, when do you want to do it? Come up and have a look. And then when I went up and had a look at it, and they showed it to me, because they're very proud of this, you know,
yeah.
Norman
Foster
building.
Well, they made a massive investment in just the window washing.
Right, let alone the building itself.
Right.
So, yeah, they were very proud of the architecture of the building, of the systems that you know, were used to maintain it. And then when I got up on the roof that first day, I said, so what I really want to be able to do is go out on this thing. And they sort of, you know, they consulted with one another and they said, yeah, well, that's fine. You'll just have to be trained to use it. So that in the end, that's what I did.
How long does it take to get trained up on
a morning.
Yeah. All right. It wasn't like you were going to window washing school for...
No. But there was a period of time where I thought that I was going to have to do that, which is like a six-month course.
I think about like, you know, super romantic reading of that story. The reason that I would think that they wouldn't want you out there is because it's like this totally protected, very, very rarefied air. You kind of get the impression that maybe they don't want anyone to know like how kind of glorious it is up there.
Well, but in the case of those guys, that you're absolutely right. They really did want to. They wanted people to know what it was like to do that job, and they wanted people to see the view, and they wanted me to see it and experience it. And you know, one of the guys who worked at the Empire State, when I went up there to clean the windows on the observation deck with him one morning, and he said that his wife, who worked down further downtown, used to come up and have breakfast with him there in the mornings. So they had these, a lot of them had these kind of quite sweet stories about their relationship with the buildings they worked in.
You're writing all these stories, you've been doing this for a long time, both these profiles and these long narrative pieces that take a lot of time, they take a lot of money, a lot of these stories,
right,
to do well. And you've been doing it for a while. I mean, how are you feeling about the state of things? Do you feel like you're going to be able to keep doing this work in the way you want to for a long time going forward? And I guess another question is, like, I feel like it's interesting that you were thinking about what the sort of larger theme in your work is before we sat down, because I was trying to think about it too, and there isn't one really. I mean, you're kind of all over the map. You've done a lot of really different kinds of stories,
right? But there are things that I prefer to write about.
Okay, so what are those?
Crime. I mean, like crime narrative.
And those are expensive.
Well, they can, but they're more. They're expensive in the sense that they're time consuming. They're expensive for me because it takes, you know, a lot of the time you've got to wait for someone to be sent. You read about it happening, then you've got to wait for somebody to be sentenced. Then you've got to see if they'll talk to you. Then the time span of reporting them can be very long.
Do you have a bunch of them going at once? Like, do you have letters out to prisons all over the country?
No. I wish I did. But I don't. I mean, I've got a couple of things going, but not. I don't have some huge dossier of like a dozen of these things going the whole time.
If that curiosity isn't going to wane for you, how do you feel about your sort of ability to keep doing these in terms of where magazines are at?
I think that this is I mean, my experience in talking to editors is that these kind of narrative, these yarns, those are the stories that everyone wants because they're really hard to find.
Yeah,
they're hard to find stories where things go wrong just late enough in the process to make a really interesting story of how they got to that point. You know, because all too frequently what happens is that your criminal steps out of the front door of his house and trips over his shoelaces and is in cuffs before he gets off the floor, you know.
Well, this one, the Atavist one, 1,000 Pounds of Dynamite, is a pretty good version of that. You can't get much better on the getting close, but not quite all the way.
Not quite.
You should go pick it up. Adam, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week, Destiny Johnson. Thanks very much to Adam Higginbotham for coming in, not only on a Sunday, but sitting in this sweltering room. It was worth it. The story, it's a holy shit story. What else can I say? 1,000 Pounds of Dynamite, available now from the Atavist. Read it on the website. Download the apps. Get it for your Kindle. It is a yarn. We'll be back next week.